time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
People have been saying there are too many mutual funds since the 80s.
For all the talk of smart beta, they haven't pulled in huge assets. The active managers are showing up in the ETF space.
Dave, honestly, I'm not even sure where to begin with this commission-free story because it seems like it should be relatively straightforward on the surface, but then when you start peeling back all the layers, there's actually a lot here. I think the implications are more than just investors saving a few bucks on trades. I guess let's start with the basics just to make sure everyone's up to speed, and then we can certainly get into some of the other stuff. I will say I do think most investors understand because ETFs trade intraday like stocks, you typically pay a small ticket charge whenever you buy or sell shares, right? $5-6, which is no different than when you buy or sell shares of Amazon or Netflix stock. And what's happened is over the past several years, more and more brokers like Schwab and TD Ameritrade, they've offered a set lineup of ETFs commission-free. They've removed that small ticket charge for a subset of ETFs. So let's start there. Do you want to explain how this model has generally worked in the past?
Yeah. So in the past, if you were a sort of, say, a mid-tier ETF provider who was looking to get more exposure for your products, you would go to a Schwab or to an E-Trade or a Fidelity, and you would offer them a fee of some sort. Usually it's some sort of basis point derived fee. So they sort of based on the amount of assets that might be at Schwab or at Fidelity. And in an exchange for that fee, they would take your ETFs and make them commission free. And so that was, you know, effectively a marketing expense from the issuer to try to get more exposure by making their product more attractive on a particular platform. I think one of the most interesting things here now, and I think you're right, I think this really started with Vanguard going commission free on all ETFs a while ago, is what happens to those deals. And I haven't gotten a clear answer from anybody, but if you were already paying, say, I don't know, 10 or 15 or 20 basis points to a given broker, do you still pay that? Because now those ETFs are going to be commission-free along with, you know, every stock in the U.S. market. So it really does change the nature of the relationship between the issuer and the broker. I think you're right. For investors, it's pretty straightforward. You're just saving a little bit of money. But I think it's much more interesting what's happening upstream in the ecosystem.
Dave, going back to that Vanguard announcement, which was last July, so they announced they would offer just about every ETF commission free, pretty much everything except leverage and inverse ETFs, if you're trading at Vanguard. And I don't think there's any question what they were trying to do is blow up this whole pay-to-play model that you just described, right? They wanted to shine a light on this because they were unwilling to pay-to-play. Can you talk more about that as a particular catalyst for how we got here today?
Well, you know, I think the ETF industry has been about transparency really from the very beginning. And one of the places there hasn't been much transparency is in this sort of pay to play behind the scenes thing. And it's shown up in multiple ways. The cleanest way is the one we've been talking about where, you know, some to call it 20 basis points goes to Schwab from the issuer based on the assets at Schwab. That's a very clean, simple transaction, and it's hard to argue that there's anything, you know, unseemly about that at all. It's just a marketing expense. But it is also the case that in some platforms, if you want sort of premium shelf space, for lack of a better term, it's not just about those basis points. You might be asked to fund a marketing campaign with that broker. You might be asked to sponsor a conference that they're running. And those things are very behind the scenes. They're much harder to see. And so I suspect what's going to happen is you'll see more of those kinds of arrangements because the revenue from these sort of pure pay for non-transaction fee presents, those revenues are going to go away.
Putting the pay to play model aside, I'm curious, what role do you think somebody like Robinhood played in this whole, battle that we've now seen here recently, right? They launched commission-free trading for everything, I think back in 14 or 15.
Right.
So how impactful do you think that was?
There have been sort of no cost or very, very low cost brokerages, frankly, for about the past 10 years. Most of them have been smaller niche players. Robinhood is certainly the one that's gotten the most play in the press and has really marketed towards a millennial and post-millennial audience. It's a very different play. I think you have to look at Interactive Brokers as the prime mover here. Interactive Brokers has been, frankly, for quite some time, the go-to platform for active traders, for full folks that are making a lot of trades, not just an occasional quarterly rebalance, but people who sort of fundamentally trade for a living or as a very significant hobby. And you know, they've consistently ground down the pricing on this, and that's competed for the very best customers at the TD Ameritrades and the Schwabs, right? TD Ameritrade and Schwab make a lot of their commission money from those active traders, not from mom and pop investors doing a couple trades a year. So when Interactive Brokers was willing to go that far, I think that broke it all wide open.
Okay, so from an investor standpoint, let's talk about the pros and cons of commission-free trading. Where do you fall on this overall? Do you think this is largely positive for end investors?
Oh, of course. I mean, anytime you remove friction from the system, I think it is sort of an inherent good. The challenge, you know, Jack Bogle, rest in peace, from Vanguard, is probably rolling over in his grave because his biggest concern about ETFs, literally till the day he died, was that they encouraged trading from people who should be investing. So I suppose if there is any downside, and I'm not sure I believe it's a big one, it's that you've now made trading incredibly easy and frictionless for a huge swath of investors. And most investors shouldn't be trading. Most investors should be, you know, looking at their portfolio quarterly or even yearly, not day to day, making lots and lots of trades. So if this encourages a lot of bad trading behavior, sure, that's not necessarily a good thing. For smart investors who are not doing that, you've just removed, you know, a little bit of expense from your life. It's not going to be a lot. You know, if you've got a 6 or 7 ETF portfolio and you're rebalancing that quarterly, what's that, maybe 20 or 30 trades a year? So you've saved $100 or $200. But, you know, $100 or $200 isn't nothing.
What about statements that we heard last week, such as there's nothing ever free in investing? And so by my rough math, if you look at Schwab, TD, and E-Trade, they chopped about $1.6 billion in annual revenues combined, which, you know, on the surface, yeah, that's money that stays in investors' pockets. But these companies are obviously for profit, and there are other ways they make money. I think the one that's getting a lot of attention now are cash sweeps.
Right.
So net interest, the difference between the rate that an investor gets on their cash and then, you know, how the in company, somebody like Schwab, is investing it. There's also discussion around payment for order flow. So, you know, how much do you think investors' radar should be up on those sorts of things?
Well, for the most part, I don't think investors need to worry about payment for order flow. You know, that's very much in the plumbing. We're talking about just fractional basis points that could possibly affect you as an investor. Investors are still protected by the national market system, which demands that there's best execution. Those things are still heavily monitored. So I don't think there's some concern that all of a sudden your trade quality is going to plummet because you're not paying for it. So I don't worry too much about that. As far as where that, you know, $1 billion is going to get made up by the industry, I think we've seen it, right? We've recognized that investing and trading is largely a solved problem. And the really interesting work is all being done on advice. It's about how you get investors through the pathway from being an investor to, say, a retiree. And that's why you've seen the huge boom in robo-advisor platforms. You know, I would argue that, you know, if we look back on this in 10 years, we're going to look at the Schwabs and E-Trades of the world and marvel at the advice businesses they've built and the 10, 20, 30 basis points they're pulling in on average across those advised assets, and the trading costs will be irrelevant. All that said, it's worth noting that the market realized this was going to hit revenue really quickly, and the shares of these brokerages got hit real hard.
Yeah, so I don't know if you saw this last week, Dave. I ran a Twitter poll, and who knows what the composition of my Twitter followers is. It's probably better I don't know. But I asked the question, if you could only have one of these features from your brokerage or robo, which would you choose? And the options I gave were low-cost financial advice, commission-free trading, competitive cash yields, or proprietary cheap funds. And I've got to tell you, I was surprised. Commission-free trading won with like 45% of the vote.
Wow.
And, you know, I just think we're talking $5 or $6 a trade here that you're saving. And I think to your point, it's much more impactful when you start looking at things like financial advice. And again, I would go back to cash sweeps just because I don't think it's something that people have a full understanding of. But I guess, does that surprise you at all? It sounds like it does.
It does surprise me because, you know, as you point out, for most investors, this is probably the least impactful of those choices you put out there. And I would agree with you, competitive cash yields would probably be far, far more impactful, right? I mean, if you've got even just a $10,000 balance sitting in an account that's effectively making zero, you know, there are places out there now that have teaser rates in the 1% and 2%. You know, Wealthfront has its sort of cash bank approach that's yielding quite a bit, right? That's far more than you would probably spend in commissions, just having that competitive cash yield. And yet most of these brokerages actually have really miserable cash yields unless you do something intentional and move your money into some sort of cash plus sweep vehicle, like a, you know, a money market mutual fund that's got a little juice to it or something that reaches a little further out on the duration curve.
Yeah. And I'll even tie that back to something you were touching on earlier with investor behavior. I think in just about every way, there's never been a better time to be an investor because costs have come down across the board. There are more options, transparency, et cetera. But Alpha Architects' Wes Gray tweeted out last week that the opportunity to be a terrible investor has never been better in the history of investing, right? Just because of how easy it is to shoot yourself in the foot now. But my counter to that, and going back to what you're talking about with investor behavior and then, you know, talking about these cash sweeps, you know, I don't think $5 or $6 makes that big of a difference to investors who are already poorly behaved. The old saying, trader's going to trade, right? But for disciplined investors, this does remove a small cost. And so if you understand the other areas where these companies may be making money, let's take, again, cash sweeps as an example, and you know perhaps you need to go look for higher yielding options there. When you do trade, if you're well disciplined, you still can save that $5 or $6. Point being that good behaved investors, this can be a positive overall. Going back to the pay-to-play model, now that appears to be breaking down, I feel like that's potentially a huge win for smaller ETF providers, just because I think a decent chunk of investors, for better or worse, I'd say for worse, began and ended their ETF due diligence process with commission-free ETF lists. So do you agree with that, that maybe investors will start putting more emphasis on things like exposure, and so therefore that could perhaps give smaller providers a better shot?
Well, there's no question this gives smaller providers a better shot because it removes a barrier to entry. A lot of them couldn't afford the pay-to-play to get on a commission-free platform, particularly if it was a brand new fund. So now, you know, effectively every, Will Ryan's fund that you're talking about later in the show, that's trading commission-free at Schwab just because it exists, right? And that is for sure a benefit to the smaller provider. But, you know, I think we're just going to see the way the gatekeeping happens shift. I would expect in a year we'll start seeing more quote-unquote select lists, right, of sort of pre-due diligence approved ETFs. And then the question becomes, how legitimate is that due diligence process and how much of those processes are just pay to play in a different wrapper? So I think investors should be skeptical as they see sort of new select lists show up at various brokers and ask real hard questions about how does a fund end up on this preferred list of a couple hundred ETFs.
What do you think Fidelity is going to do? I mentioned they're really the only major player that is not all commission free. What do you expect them to do?
It strikes me as inconceivable that they won't follow suit, to be honest, right? We now have the majority of the individual brokerage community offering free trading on everything. It doesn't strike me that Fidelity Brokerage Services can really continue to be competitive and hold the pricing that they have now. So it may not be instantaneous. You know, Fidelity is a privately held company, can afford to take their time. They can afford to be slow. They don't need to worry about what the market does to their stock price on a quarter to quarter basis. So they may wait a little bit. They may wait a quarter and see whether or not this has any impact on either new account openings or trade volumes or losing customers. And you know, if they believe that they can hang on to this revenue, they probably will. But I suspect long term, they're going to have to play ball.
What about somebody like Robinhood, who we were talking about earlier? They basically built their value prop on commission-free trading, at least from my perspective. Do you think they're dead in the water? Last valuation I saw of that company was like $8 billion.
Yeah, it's certainly, we have to acknowledge this is removing the baseline revenue from an entire industry. And that, you know, for an investor in that industry, if you were going to buy Robinhood's, you know, shares or Schwab shares, you have to recognize that this is a hard pill to swallow. So I think it's negative for Robinhood's business in the short term. That being said, I think a huge part of Robinhood's success is not just the pricing structure. It's the way they interface with their clients, right? It's the app. It's how they work with their clients. So I think Robinhood still has a healthy business, but this definitely removes a competitive advantage.
Dave, about 2 minutes left. I did want to ask you, there was a really interesting Forbes piece last week. It was written by Simon Moore, and he suggested that commission-free trading could actually help speed the adoption of direct indexing, because obviously commission-free trading allows direct indexing to be more economically feasible to smaller investors. And where he was heading was that perhaps that might then hurt ETFs, right? More investors might choose to go the direct indexing route. Of course, you, Laura, and I covered this direct indexing topic in pretty good detail several weeks ago after the Wealthstat conference, and we talked about this threat to ETFs. But I'm just curious, any thoughts on Simon's theory?
Yeah, absolutely. There, you know, there are really two versions of direct indexing. There's the version where you literally give your money to a firm and they custody it and they manage the direct indexing process. And then there's what I would call the directed version, which is you hire a direct indexing firm, they plug into Schwab or to TD, and they direct the trades at that platform for you. So, you know, they're the ones making 500 trades to replicate the S&P 500 with a twist. But they're doing that through Schwab's platform. And that's actually sort of the majority of the growth in the direct indexing space is those directed sort of advisors, if you will. And that obviously a huge cost has just gone away. Now, most of those folks had managed to negotiate a different rate, et cetera, but there's no question that this makes it much easier for, say, a small firm who thinks they've got a great take on direct indexing to sort of bolt into the ecosystem and remove a lot of friction.
Dave, great having you back on the podcast. It had been a little while, a few weeks, I think.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
Always good having you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was ETF.com's Dave Nodding.